ready to go?
Yeah,
I think we are. Okay, welcome everybody to our first board meeting in our Canary Wharf office. It all looks picture perfect here, and I believe that the can get an even clearer view of our operations than before with newer equipment. And I hope that will also help even further furthering the transparency of our meetings. So having said that, I give the floor to Ross to lead us through a couple of papers on dynamic risk management.
Just on transparency, I think that the mics in this room are particularly good, so no side conversations unless you want them webcast as well.
Thank you very much, Hans. Today, the staff will present agenda papers 4B and 4C for discussion. As usual, paper 4A has been provided listing the tentative decisions to date, but I don't plan to discuss that paper any further. Given the length of paper 4B, I'm going to propose we start with that one. So the purpose of this paper is to discuss the information content that should be provided in situations of imperfect alignment. Here we discuss measurement of imperfect alignment, the presentation and recognition thereof, and then discuss the potential for minimum performance thresholds within the DRM accounting model. Regarding today's session, I suggest that the board discuss each section of the paper in the order laid out in the paper, and I will ask the board the questions for each section prior to moving on to the next section. So the first section is measurement of imperfect alignment. In paragraphs 10 through 24, the paper discusses why the measurement of imperfect alignment should be required within the DRM model, proposes a method for measuring imperfect alignment, and discusses the frequency of that measurement. The reasons for measurement can be found in paragraphs 10 through 15, but to summarize quickly, the reasons are to quantify the strength of a link between the items designated within the model, provide a quantification that speaks to management's ability to efficiently and effectively protect the entity's economic resources, and to note, a requirement to measure would maintain consistency with the existing requirements of IFRS 9 regarding hedge accounting. In paragraph 15, the staff comment that an entity could measure imperfect alignment by comparing the benchmark derivatives with the designated derivatives as discussed during the June 2018 board meeting. As a reminder, the benchmark derivatives are those that perfectly align the asset profile with the target profile. We elaborate on the content provided by comparing the benchmark and the designated in the following section. Frequency of measurement is discussed in paragraphs 16 through 23, and the staff proposed that given the dynamic nature of portfolios, measurement should be completed on an ongoing basis, i.e. prior to each change in inputs, or absent a change in inputs at each reporting date. Regarding the timing of measurement, this is discussed in paragraphs 16 through 23, and note the model differentiates between a change in inputs and a change in assumption, as discussed in paragraphs 19 and 20. With this, I would ask the board if they agree with questions 1 and 2. More specifically, does the board agree that entities should be required to measure imperfect alignment and that measurement should take place on an ongoing basis?
Sue?
Yes, I agree with questions 1 and 2. So that there'd be a requirement to measure imperfect alignment in the first instance, and also the proposal that it be done on an ongoing basis. I guess, and I agreed with the examples that you had in this first section where you look at if there's a change in inputs that you would have to measure at that point in time, because if I understand it correctly, basically with what you're proposing later on with the comparison of the fair values of the sort of benchmark derivative and the actual derivative, we're capturing the difference in the sort of PVs of the future cash flows. But I guess two questions that come from that. One is that would seem to mean that if you wanted to capture all of the imperfection and you had a very dynamic situation, in theory, the benchmark derivative would be changing on a very constant basis, you know, maybe even every day. And in theory, at a pure conceptual level, that would mean to capture all of the imperfect alignment, you'd need to be making that measurement comparison very frequently, subject to any discussion we might have later on about operationality and simplification. Is that true?
Yes.
And I guess one other question I had in terms of the timing of testing. So in this first part of the paper, we focus on where there's a change in inputs. So where you know that there's been a change in what's in the portfolio, et cetera, and so you might make a decision about changing your designated derivatives. And later on, we talk about making a measurement when you've got a change in assumptions. And I don't want to peek ahead to that too much. But I just wondered whether there's something that could be slightly in between. So, for example, if I had started out thinking that during this period I was going to have a particular outstanding of, mortgages in my portfolio, and then it turns out that during the period, while I wasn't noticing, if you like, there was suddenly a prepayment that had actually occurred. So I hadn't had a change in my assumptions.
Yep.
I wasn't aware necessarily that there was a change in inputs, but something changed. I guess I'd just want us to think about how we make sure that that element of imperfection is definitely captured, even though risk management wasn't consciously dealing with a change in inputs. It wasn't actually taking an action at that point in time. It hadn't changed its assumptions, but there was a difference that had actually occurred. Is that fair? Is that slightly in between the two examples you've got?
I think it is slightly in between. I mean, I think we've said a change in inputs would probably capture when something matures or would be derecognized. And so I think if something is derecognized earlier than you thought it was going to be derecognized.
The intention would be it would be captured.
Yeah,
so intention. I'm picking up the risk of maybe you didn't realize and it happened. We'd still want them to be captured.
Yes, absolutely.
I think one of the points that you're making, Sue, is this cutoff between input and assumption. What is the change? And obviously, certain times, it can blur a little bit. But yes, the point you made is the derecognition, like a prepayment. So it's a derecognition event that's happened. So that should be a change in input that should be picked up. But I think fair point, we need to be careful when we come up with the communication of this, that the in-betweeners don't get dropped just because we haven't been clear in how when we draft this.
Yes. And John.
Thank you, Hans. I also support the staff's proposal, EC1 and question one and question two. I think it will provide the timely and transparent information to the users. I got two questions, maybe need further clarifications. One is about the frequency of the changes in input, and also the frequency of managing risk, whether those frequency always at the same time. Yeah, sometimes maybe in practice, maybe changes in input first and then managing risk maybe lagged behind of those changing in inputs. So I would like to confirm, because if you look at the paper, we all always, you know, assume that those frequency at the same time, same period. So if in the practice, maybe they are different. So what will happen with regard to accounting treatment for those differences? And the second question I want to make sure, because the paper said, I agree with that the measuring imperfect alignment should be on ongoing basis, but I would like to make sure whether it should be made immediately prior to each change in input, or because the paper said all at a minimum could be made at each reporting date. So it's an option, or basically the entity should measure alignment, imperfect alignment immediately prior to each change in input. Only if there are no any changes in input, then the entity allowed to measure those imperfect alignment at each reporting date, or only if there are no significant changes in input, then those entities allow them to measure imperfect alignment at each reporting date, because different dates, you measure at different date, maybe the accounting result will be different. So I would like to clarify well at exactly which date, what's the meaning of ongoing basis, exactly what we're talking here.
So the meaning was perhaps the middle part of what you had said there, that it should be immediately prior to a change in inputs. If there isn't any changes in inputs, you should do it at the reporting date. So it's not a choice. If there's a change in inputs, the proposal is you should measure before the change in inputs. If there are no changes in inputs that occur, then you should be measuring at least at the reporting date. So
it's not a choice, Jianqiao.
It's not a choice. So it's clear, but whether it's there are no any changes in input or there are no any significant, you know, changes in input.
Jianqiao, that brings us almost to the materiality questions and everything. Yeah. So if it's no significant change, I don't expect people to remeasure. So we have just drafted it as we have done in other standards, no change in inputs. So then otherwise, if we start going into significant, we'll have to start defining what we mean by significant.
Yes, the reason why I ask this question, I think in this paper, we should have consistent principle in place with regarding what's the meaning of the ongoing gases or what's the changes in inputs, because paragraph 24, the last sentence, we did say that if there is no changes in input, so, and paragraph, I see, later on. Let me check.
If we have been inconsistent.
Yes, the letter, there are some paragraphs that there is no
to be
significant change in input, and it said that those companies are allowed to use, you know, to measure the imperfect alignment at the each reporting date. So it seemed there are some inconsistent between
different paragraphs. We will take care of that. No, thanks for pointing
I think just to make those paragraphs consistent.
Yeah. And on the bits, another thing also just to point out, we haven't got it. We will come to you with a simplifications paper, because this is the ideal case, how to bring in the dynamic nature where we will discuss these things.
Okay, thank you.
Anne? I agree with the staff recommendations. I have two questions. Firstly, question one, when you say they should be required to measure, you're thinking measure, and then later on you'll think about recognition or disclosure, and that comes later in the paper. So in a way, this question is just setting the scene, isn't it? Because we can't actually go no to this question, because if we go no to this question, we don't have a model. Is that right?
Recognise or disclose, yes.
Yep, okay. Number two, the ongoing basis, I also agree with that. And I just wonder how that actually works. I know you're going to tell us more later about how it works in practice. But let's say in one of your examples, there's the opening year, there's a change, and then there's a close of the year. So we've got some remeasuring going on. Are we going to add them all up, and then there's number, and we net it, and we get to see the net number at the end? What I'm getting at is, are we going to see what's been happening over the year, or are we just going to see one net number at the end? Because I'm thinking about feedback that I saw on IFRS 7, which said, oh, you tell us the disclosure at the year end, which is fine, but I have no idea what went on during the year. So whether you'll explain this to us later or not, I'm just wondering the extent to which we're going to actually see what happened during the year, or do we just get a net number at the end? Mm-hmm.
The measurement or the recognition part, we haven't gone into the details of the disclosure and presentation as yet, Anne, and then we can discuss whether it's a flow concept or a static concept.
Okay.
As of now, all we're talking about, as you said, for the recognition and the measurement at which points in time you have to do it.
Okay.
So if it's only at the quarter end, let's say, that's the number you get because there's nothing happening, so you just pick up what is the difference coming up. And that will get, remember, it's on a fair value basis, so we'll have to see how the rolling goes forward. How that is disclosed for the information side, we will come back later.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure.
But I think I'd add on something. My takeaway from your question, and it's a good point that Anne raises the use of the word measurement rather than recognition, but I thought that the 30,000-foot question I think you're asking us in question one is, do you agree that we should have this sort of basic idea, which is similar to our hedge accounting thinking, where we think about ineffectiveness, where we're trying to capture as a piece of information the difference between what might have been perfect and what we've actually done?
Yes.
And that's the entry level, and how that gets recognized, where geography will come to, and also Anne's question where how we disclose that coming to later.
Doug?
Thank you. I think DRM system is excellent idea. The one of the uniqueness of this proposal is to have a benchmark derivatives in between. So as long as benchmark derivative is a perfect derivative, we can make the system very consistent with IFRS 9, as if it were just a simple cash flow hedge. So I would agree almost everything about what you are asking. However, my question is, how can we prove that the benchmark derivative is always representing fairly the risk profile of the company? That, how can we monitor? We haven't really discussed it. Because if the perfect derivative is not perfect, then everything we are doing about imperfectness test doesn't mean anything at all. Mm-hmm. So therefore, how frequently we should monitor that the benchmark derivative is perfect, and how would you do that?
So the benchmark derivative, as we've described it, saying it would be the derivative that accomplishes the risk management strategy effectively, that's a matter of fact rather than a matter of opinion. And so it should be able to be proved whether or not the entity has done exactly what its strategy said it was going to do. That implies the strategy has to be defined at a level that you could do that. But I think that's just a matter of fact and can be proved mathematically. I don't comment anywhere in the papers about how often we're going to check that the benchmark derivative is what it is. That's not something we've discussed in the paper.
Yeah, but we have discussed what the benchmark derivative is all about in the past discussion. Yeah. That there is an equation between the asset profile and target profile. The difference between asset profile and target profile is the perfect benchmark derivative. So then, as long as asset profile and
the target
profile is okay, then benchmark derivative is just the residual differences. So then they can monitor it as a matter of fact. However, the aim of this project is to see if the their risk management is sound enough and the risk hedge is okay or not, working well. Then the question is, the investor want to know the quality of their risk management. So then the quality of risk management totally depends upon how they define the asset profile and target profile. And the question is, if the asset profile is and the target profile is appropriate or not. That is the point that they want to monitor and see ongoing basis. Because later you are going to discuss qualification issue. And if there are some portfolio, some derivative, some assets are not qualified, then it is same, you have to go to the same process. So then that means the first question we need to monitor is whether or not the risk management set of asset profile and target profile is appropriate.
Coming back, you have got a lot of things in there, Tuck. Just coming back to your question. Regarding when we start off with the objectives of the project, we always said that we are not going to opine on what is an appropriate risk management strategy for an entity.
Okay.
That's not what we are trying to do. What the model is trying to do is capture that strategy so that the economics gets reflected and there's information. Now, I fully agree, we can certainly come back to it and everything, that the benchmark derivative has to be that target profile, it has to be monitored, and it has to be as per what we normally think on market. You can't start building things out of thin air. And then that benchmark derivative appropriately captures what your target profile and asset profile does.
Yeah.
And that comparison then achieves what we are trying to do.
Mm. One more comment.
Please.
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's why I think this is a wonderful idea. And for preparer's view, it is very clear, because once we set up the benchmark derivative, it's easy. You can do it as if it were a cash flow hedge.
Not so easy, but yes.
It's wonderful. However, the point is we totally depend on the risk management of entity. So
that's what we are trying to capture, Tuck.
From the viewpoint of transparency, it looks like you know, perfect transparency, like our IFRS 9 cash flow hedge. But there is an untransparent part behind, which is the risk management of entity-specific risk management. And I was wondering whether or not we can give much better transparency to the appropriateness of the risk management itself.
Let me again reiterate. Yeah. What is an appropriate risk management strategy, I don't think can be dictated through accounting. Mm. That is an entity-specific decision. What the model will accommodate is whatever is the strategy. Now, coming to transparency on what we're doing, these are the disclosure elements which we will come in, because as we go through the paper, you will see.
Transparency, yes, go to we'll area come to that. Disclosure.
Yes, certainly.
Thank you.
Okay. Françoise?
I agree with the staff preliminary review on these two questions. I have two comments, I think. One, in fact, to follow up on the discussion of the ongoing basis on which measurement is made. My reading of your paper is that, in fact, the frequency of that measurement is dictated by the risk management practice of the entity. So before they take mitigating actions, they have to measure.
Well, it's not. I wouldn't say necessarily mitigating actions, because that would be, in our language, a designation of a new derivative. If the portfolio that has been designated per the, as we've discussed in the qualifying criteria discussions, if there's a change to those per their policies, that would trigger measurement as well. So, it's not just the derivatives that changes that triggers measurement. So,
and the other point I wanted to raise is that. In paragraph 23 and in other places in this paper, you refer to information being available because the risk management strategy is in place. But I think the information available is available in without any restrictions, without any form of eligibility criteria. And so there may be a discrepancy between the information that we're seeking and because so far we have restrictions. So I think it's important when you ascertain that the information is available, you have this restriction in mind.
That's right. Yeah.
And also I think this is true as long as the model that has been described, asset profile, target profile, is a fair representation of what is done in practice. So with these caveats.
No, absolutely fair. So as what you're saying, the information contents, we have put an accounting filter in place. So there's got to be a filter. And how people do it and everything, that's where the outreach will come in.
Daryl.
Just following the discussion around the table, maybe picking up on Tuck's use of the word appropriateness of the, and I guess what we're trying to, my understanding is we're trying to perhaps give insight into the effectiveness of the, in other words, whether or not that then leads me to the question of the ongoing basis and something that Anne said worried me just a little bit in this. So I just want to make sure I've understood correctly. So the idea of the ongoing measurement is that I don't just want to measure at a point in time how successful my measurement has been over the whole period, because later you're going to ask us whether or not we should treat under-hedging and over-hedging differently. Essentially, what's going to happen is we are saying ongoing measurement means I will not be able to offset the outcome of my under-hedging with the outcome of my over-hedging and just get a net outcome. I will treat all of my under-hedge circumstances different to all of my over-hedge circumstances different, even if it's on the same portfolio.
This is where we come to the netting question, whether you have
the same. But the importance of this ongoing measurement is that's the only way I can see that. Otherwise, I'm just looking back at the net outcome.
Sorry, let me understand that. The position which you measure is for the past, like you would do in a normal cash flow hedge. And it's a cumulative measurement at that point in particular time. And what we are asking right now is that's you measure at every time you change an input or at every reporting date. What the outcome of that measurement is either an over or an under. And then the accounting of that follows subsequently.
I think I want to build on what I think what TAC was talking about, which is the information that's provided to investors and what they will and won't get out of this. And this isn't a sort of view in one direction or the other, more partly a question, partly an observation. So if I look at what we have today under hedge accounting, we know that because hedge accounting is voluntary and because our disclosures are linked to the application of hedge accounting, the information that you get about risk management is determined by how broad the scope is of your application of hedge accounting, and you may have a lot of stuff going on that you won't know about that are hedge accounting disclosures because you've chosen not to apply hedge accounting. And we've sort of accepted that as a parameter. Yep. And if you go back to the old DRM proposals in the discussion paper, one of the big debates we had with people was about how comprehensive the information should be, whether it should capture all of the risk management that you've got going on or what's in the model. Yep. And there was a lot of unrest with some of those aspects. Now, as I understand it, what we're proposing here is that what we'd be capturing in terms of the imperfect alignment would be taking into account what I've put into my target profiles and the actual risk management that I've undertaken, where there's a difference between what would be perfect and what's not, what you've actually got. That's what we're capturing.
Yep.
Right? But if I had a situation where I've got a portfolio which is fluctuating quite a lot, if from a risk management perspective I just sort of let that happen and then every 6 months or something I stopped and reconfigured things, okay, the stuff that I hadn't really been risk managing that I just let happen would be outside our model and we wouldn't be capturing that sort of by design.
If that's how you've defined the model. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. And if you weren't risk managing, that's fine because you weren't doing it anyway, so you're not sort of missing any information about your risk management. But let's say that you are from an economic risk management perspective as opposed to accounting.
Yep.
Whenever there's changes in the amount of the portfolio, you are economically actually trying to match your hedges with what's gone on. But from the perspective of our DRM model, from a designation perspective, you only do it at snatches in time. Right. So you risk manage on a dynamic, say, a daily basis, for argument's sake, but let's say for a quarterly basis, you stop and say, okay, I'm now designating, my portfolio's changed a bit, I'm now changing my designated derivatives that I'm calling part of my dynamic risk management process, etc.
Yep.
So it's snapshots of the economic hedging that are going on that I'm formally designating. Our model is really focusing in on that designated bit of it, right?
Yeah.
So we wouldn't be capturing necessarily the full economic hedging that's going on. And the differences in that, people by choosing how often they designate and how often they adjust what they've called is in the scope of this model,
yeah,
will determine a different outcome in terms of imperfection that's captured. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but I think it's consistent with what we do with hedge accounting, where by designating what you include in the hedge accounting model, you get a slightly different picture of the risk management that's going on. Unless we're saying that whenever you risk manage, you have to include it in your designations, which I don't think we are.
We are not, because then we have criteria about amortized cost and everything, and then we'll have to go into, yeah, because remember, in certain instances, I've also heard that people will include provision amounts in these balances of the liability, so we haven't gone that far. You are driven, I think Gary mentioned it, you live and die by that designation. Now, remember, with the mechanics, if you bring things in later, once you haven't done, there is a cost because you have derivatives at zero and the assets are not moving. And then the model will pick it up. Now, whether we want to extend that, that's how the model works. Now, whether in disclosures we want to disclose things which are not covered by the model, that is a different discussion, which we also had with the PRA.
And the only reason I'm pointing it out, and I'm not saying I disagree with that, because I don't think it's inconsistent with what we've done elsewhere, and it might be the most practical way to get the model to work as well if you've got very dynamic actual risk management going on every day. I'm not sure how realistic it is to expect people to be doing this very formal designation process every day. But I think when we look at the end at what it is we've come up with and the information we're telling people they're getting out of the model, we need to be careful to be clear what may in fact be going on economically that wouldn't be captured in the model, so that we're being sort of, I think that was partly what you were getting at, Tuck, the transparency
yes, what is setting expectations of what this model will come up
with. What it captures and what it doesn't capture.
We have that issue with PRA as well. We need to be conscious.
Okay.
Gary?
Thank you. I do agree with your staff's recommendations, but sort of reflecting on, since we're spending time on when do you measure, I mean, I think looking at paragraph 19, one of the times you'd measure this change in input, well, I would think in all but the simplest of circumstances, and just keep focused on banks, inputs change minute to minute. You know, so as the practical result is you're measuring daily, that, I mean, loans get paid, they get originated all day long. So the beginning of the day balance is different than the end. So I think the practical consequence of it, you're probably measuring daily. Am I missing something there? Then I'm thinking of follow-up on that.
I don't think you're missing anything there, and I think we commented later in one of the paragraphs that for a very large money center bank, that that's a completely accurate statement, and that implies if their risk management is on a daily basis because everything's funded on a daily basis, that would imply a daily measurement, and that's, to Sue's point, a lot of measurements. So
they designate on a daily basis?
Yeah, if they risk manage and designate on a daily basis, then that's a change in inputs on a daily basis, and so that's measurement on a daily basis.
But I think, I don't know if a bank would do it when you come back in another meeting and your simplifications.
Yeah.
The fact that you might be doing something daily, which is just aligning portfolio balances, does not necessarily automatically, I'm measuring gain and loss, you know, mark-to-market adjustments. I know I got my notional amounts lined up perfectly. I don't necessarily need to understand, you know, the measurement of imperfection on it. And I think, kind of looking forward, this is not just a period-end measure. The reality is you're really doing average balances during the period, you know, and there's certainly some disclosures that are out there. It's high, you know, take a three-month window, you know, highest average balance, and you align that derivatives against the portfolios, gives you a sense of how active and dynamic it is. If your average balances are pretty close and for, say, the reporting period,
then
and if your highest and lowest amounts outstanding don't really deviate much between the portfolio and the derivative, so you got a pretty effective strategy, and that's a very good way. I think disclosures, what is your risk management strategy, are going to be critical in these things. But that would kind of give a sense of my netting the overs and unders, right? Really kind of nailing it in as close as you can.
No arguments there, Gary. Even the weighted average and everything, you're peeking way ahead to future board meetings. Let us come to the simplifications. Okay.
Mary?
I may be peeking ahead also, but I think only within the paper. It's supportive of the staff recommendations and for questions one and two. Just something I note that I'd like to ask you to think about, maybe answered elsewhere in the paper, maybe in a future meeting, is a notion that we wrestle with in the IAS 34 context of whether the frequency of measurement affects the reported results. So the piece that I'm picking ahead about is if we go ahead and have an asymmetrical model for under-hedging versus over-hedging, it means that the sum of the ups and downs is not going to be equal to the measurement once at the end for an individual item. I'm building on Daryl's point. The sum of the ups and downs, if you measured every up and down, if you have an asymmetrical model, is not going to be the same as what's the net change from day A to day B, you know, if there are ups and downs in between there. And I just think we have to think about that, whether the frequency of measurement will impact your reported result and if we're okay with that outcome. I'm not looking for an answer today. I don't think it changes my responses to questions one and two. And it is peeking ahead to the, you know, to the staff recommendation about under-hedging versus over-hedging. But just kind of put that on the follow-up list.
Okay. Thank you. I wasn't sure when to raise this issue, but seeing that Tack and Sue have mentioned information which is useful in thinking about the information content. I mean, as I read through the paper, that was a question constantly at the back of my mind. I think it's a critical issue. And as we've talked, I guess there are three pieces of information. One, the effectiveness of the risk management, the DRM risk management process. The impact would be the second area. And the third, I guess, is then the risk management activities outside of the DRM process. And having read the paper, I feel like I'm sort of going through the theory. You're leading me through the theory with this paper, but we'll come back to those actual impacts. We talk about presentation disclosure at a later date. Is that the...
The impacts is how we will measure them, Nick. We need to get comfortable of what we are measuring.
Yeah.
And then we will certainly come back in significant detail, because we haven't said where you put imperfection if you measure it, where you put perfection. We haven't discussed where you could put accruals and where in OCI.
Yeah.
Let's talk about scope, too.
Scope. Yeah. Oh, and then we will talk about the scope of what is there, which is the final. That will be the final discussion.
Oswaza?
I'm also being led here by the discussion that has taken place. I mean, I think we need to be clear about our objectives. And I agree that we have the objective of reflecting the effects of risk management, the risk management strategy. And I can agree that we also want to show how this is effective or not. But our primary objective remains to report the economic performance, the economic position of the entity. So the objective of reflecting how efficient the entity is taking in implementing its risk management strategy is to me secondary to reflecting the economic position. I think it's important to have the two objectives in mind and to prioritize them.
Fair enough what you're saying, because what you're telling us that in trying to capture imperfection, we shouldn't forget the goal that what we are trying to start with, what we started with to capture the economics of risk management.
In other words, I mean, taking the absurd situation in which a risk management strategy would lead to adverse economics. Of course, it's stupid, but I would not want to say everything's fine, I don't report anything. I would want to report the adverse economics. That's the meaning of what I'm saying.
Yeah,
I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that, Francois. So say, for example, that I had a situation where risk management was going on for an entire portfolio, but they only include 10% of that risk management activity in the designation of their accounting under this model. I think at the moment we'd only be capturing how well that 10% was working, and we wouldn't be capturing how well or otherwise the other 90% would be working. Are you saying that that's okay or not okay?
I'm saying that the overall effect of the portfolio itself and how it responds to changes, and the 10% that are hedged should be reflected. And then we might have partly reporting, partly disclosures on whether they're effective in first saying that their strategy is only 10%, and second to show how effective they are in meeting that. That's what I mean.
That's what I thought.
Okay.
Model.
Still agree with the questions, but Martin?
Yeah, I also agree with the two questions, but I want to say my expectation is not so high as maybe from some what this model should reflect, because I think accounting cannot optimally reflect, okay, what happens in risk management and the quality of risk management. That is not my expectation in this project. My expectation was, okay, to if we're doing that accounting better reflects what happens in risk management than currently. Because if we compare it, if, for example, we know that hedge accounting currently is a choice. If a company is not using hedge accounting, they would, even if they have the perfect best risk management of the world, they would use in this derivatives mark-to-market through P&L and have maybe the underlying transactions, including core demand deposits, which is accrual accounting. I don't know if that gives a good picture of what is happening on the quality of risk management. I would question it. Yeah. If they're using hedge accounting with designating individual proxy hedging, I think also it is not reflecting anyhow, okay, what happened in risk management. But I think this model can better reflect that, but not perfectly and not good insight in all of that, and that is not my objective of this project. And Having said that, I think what we are doing with this, if it is imperfect aligned regarding the target profile, we're going back and saying, okay, then okay, we using that portion of the derivative which is not really aligning to the target profile, mark to market through P&L. That is all what I think is based on this question. But it is not all that is about me, okay, to be able to show now quality and how perfect risk management is, because I think accounting is not designed to do that.
That's what I was trying to say. I think that's all that this achieves as well.
Yeah.
Amaru?
Yeah. My comment was somewhat aligned with Martin's last comment. I do agree with staff. I think it's the only way to make the model work. I think it's important to, especially for outsiders, to remind that we do have read a lot of requirements in IFRS 7 regarding risk management. So I think what staff has said to us is that when they come back with disclosures, they will assess what we do or have read in terms of risk management strategies. There are a lot required here. Models, when it comes to hedge, will almost never provide a complete picture of risk management particularly in a financial institution, because there are so many aspects that they do consider. They not necessarily hedge everything. It's very expensive to hedge everything. There is no perfect hedge. Imperfection in this sense is even more important than the perfection, because the benchmark derivative to everything is very expensive, not always available. So I think when it comes to disclosure, we might find the need to provide the information that most of us are seeking here.
Mary.
I was just coming back to Francoise's marker about what we're doing. And I'm very comfortable with in terms of the concern that Francoise raised, because everything the staff is talking about does not contemplate any changes from IFRS 9's measurement of the instruments involved. So we aren't talking about not measuring a derivative at an actual derivative position at fair value. And the only modifications we're talking about are the kind of modifications we've made before in terms of the reporting of some of those, where the reporting of some of those changes in fair value occurs. And that's the same kind of thing that we contemplate with IFRS 9 and the hedging requirements in IFRS 9. So when you say we have to remember to give primacy to reporting the actual economic position, I'm comfortable that what we're talking about here would not in any way undercut, what we do for the reporting of the actual economic position. This is what additional information can we capture about the risk management activities and the way that the staff is going about, proposing that we go about doing it would not override any of the basic economic position reporting.
Okay, can I see if we can agree with the questions 1 and 2?
All in favor? Yeah.
Okay, continue.
Section 2. What is the information content provided by measuring imperfect alignment? In paragraphs 26 through 52, the staff discuss the information provided by measuring imperfect alignment and would highlight the discussion in paragraphs 28 and 29. These paragraphs explain that if an entity is imperfectly aligned, this means the entity will not receive the exact cash flows required to accomplish the risk management strategy. By comparing the change in fair value of the benchmark and the designated derivative, this quantifies in a single metric the impact of those differences in cash flows. This section introduces the examples that are used throughout the paper, and they are just that, examples. They are illustrative in nature and are not meant to be indicative of any deeper meaning. For example, no inferences should be made to these figures and the minimum performance thresholds outlined later in the paper. These examples provided elaborate on the information content that measurements provide and highlights that in cases of overhedging or where there are excess cash flows present, the entity is contractually obliged to either pay or receive cash flows that are above and beyond those required to accomplish the risk management strategy. In the cases of overhedging, measuring the change in fair value of these cash flows quantifies and communicates the potential impact of imperfect alignment on the entity's future economic resources, given market conditions in existence at the measurement date. In contrast, when an entity is underhedged, while the quantification is similar in that it provides an indication of what could occur in the future, It is different in that there is no contractual obligation to pay or receive the cash flows implied from measurement. This is because the implied cash flows do not exist. As such, the staff have argued in this section that measurement in the case of underhedging is somewhat analogous to an opportunity cost, as it quantifies the impact of an action not taken. With that, I'll ask the board question number three. Does the board agree that measuring imperfect alignment provides information about the extent to which the entity has not achieved its risk management strategy and therefore quantifies the potential impact on the entity's future economic resources?
Just a quick question that follows up from what other people were saying. So the entity can designate or not, it can have a risk management strategy and designate or not, right?
Sorry, Tom.
It was a question. The entity can have a risk management strategy and choose to designate all or part of it.
Yes.
Yes.
So just the way it's phrased, so it we're only testing the designated part.
Correct.
So what we're achieving is the designated portion of the risk management strategy.
Yes.
Okay, just for clarification. And I guess at the same time that measuring imperfect alignment is also going to what Francoise said, it is going to tell you something about the overall economic performance.
Yes, it will.
In other words, if you didn't do this, you'd be deficient in your description of the overall economic performance.
Yes.
Okay, that's it.
John Wu.
Thank you. A short clarification on that, the achievement of a risk information strategy. There is a target profile. Banks are trying to their best to meet that target profile, but they have some kind of cost constraint and availability of derivatives, swaps. But they're doing best, right? The actual achievement is a kind of an optimal outcome from the perspective of banks, right?
I use the word optimal is difficult to say, but I think it's fair to say that they work very hard to do as best as they can. So.
Yes, so I'm a little confusing, you know, because there is target profile, maybe that's too, you know, kind of ideal. But the best thing practically for the bank to achieve is a kind of a actual achievement. So what I'm saying is kind of, based on these expressions, you know, when I read your nice paper, I was a bit confused because all the banks are doing their best to do a kind of a risk management. So as Martin said, they're doing best, they're doing all the banks. But we are saying they are doing, you know, less achieved of that target profile, so we are going to have some kind of provide some information. Yeah. The investors might think this bank is a very poor performance, so they have to devalue of their, for example, stock price. But it seems to me a little confusing, this kind of information content perspective.
Tingu, the target profile is set by the bank.
Yes, sure.
They know that how they set the target profile and how they measure it is going to affect their performance. So the assumption, of course, is that there will be a degree of rationality that you won't say that I will manage 100% of my book when you practically think you can only manage 30%. If you have said I'm going to manage 50% of my book and you have not been efficient, then I think the model is giving the information for investors what they need.
Yeah, practically, and most of risk management resulting in a kind of imperfect alignment in practice, right? So as Martin, you know, Amaro said, it's quite difficult to do a kind of perfect alignment. So that's the reality. So most banks, yeah. But, so can you say if there are imperfectness, if in the case of one bank A, there's a kind of, you know, amount about 1 million euros, another one is 5 million euros, you know, we can say, you know, proportionally too. So we can say the bank has made a kind of a very poorer performance than the bank B?
How do I answer this? This is where it comes back to the disclosure, that 1 million and 5 million could all just be simply because you have got larger portfolios, but you have just been as efficient.
So you have got the same 10% inefficiency, but on a larger portfolio. Or it could be a scale of 5 times inefficiency. So yes, the number will convey, but only in conjunction with other information, as Nick and others have been pointing out.
Maybe this might relate to the tax points, maybe setting the target profile, maybe another important strategy of the...
Without a doubt.
Right.
Yeah. Without a doubt.
So...
I'd agree with what you've got in question three, I guess, subject to just following on some of the discussions we've had and Tom's confirmation. I think it does provide you with information about the extent to which you've achieved it for items that are included in your designations.
Yeah, definitely.
Mary?
Two things related to question three. One is, back on paragraph 28, you told us what we decided in, reminded us what we decided in the June 2018 meeting. And I want to, and I'm said this privately but to the staff, but I wanted to say it again publicly, is I think we should think about how we express the formulation of that June conclusion, because to me it was more that we had decided that the measurement should be the reclassification should be on the basis of the target profile, and that therefore the consequence would be that if you were perfectly aligned, the P&L you'd report would be exactly the target. But and I think I'd prefer to express it that way, because it's not focusing on the mechanical outcome. It's saying what the objective is. So it increased my skepticism when I read the question three. In terms of what am I agreeing to if I support question three, which I do, and I say that because I think the other thing that's embedded in this section that we should, I think, and this is what I want to check, that we should be explicitly signing up to, is that the way to measure imperfect alignment is the change in the difference between the fair value of the benchmark derivative and the fair value of the designated, the actual derivative. So question three just says, do you think measuring the imperfection gives you, provides information? And I agree with the caveats about, gives you information about those that are in the, in the designated model,
yep.
Or designated in the model. But I think we're signing up not only to that, but also to the conclusion that the way you measure imperfection is the difference between the change in the fair value of the benchmark and the change in the fair value of the designated. Immediate question, is that impounded in question three, the measurement basis that you set out? And I think I'm supportive if that's it, but I think we should maybe explain a bit more why that's the right way to measure.
Sorry, because not only on the imperfection, Mary, we signed up to that for perfect alignment as well. That's how we will measure it as well.
Are you asking, Mary, whether we're saying you specifically have to measure it in this way?
Yes.
By comparing the fair values of the derivatives?
Right. I'm not just saying measuring imperfection, but how you measure the degree of perfection.
It's by comparing fair values of the two derivatives. That's all we're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Okay. And I think that's implicit rather than explicit.
Yeah,
and I don't. It isn't just a way that you can do it. It's the way that you would have to do it.
Okay. Fair enough.
Because when I first started thinking about it, I was trying to mentally get over why is the change in the fair the fair value of the two instruments the right portrayal of the flow of cash flows. And I think it was helpful that you explained, A, that's how we approach it today for cash flow hedges in IFRS 9, and two, that because of the nature of the instruments we're looking at, so this conclusion relates to interest rate swaps, and that's what we're focused on in the core part of the project, but we have to remember that this is a conclusion that's specific to interest rate swaps.
And other similar instruments, not options and other things.
Well, we'd have to think about what the different characteristics of the other things are, and whether right now, for interest rate swaps, we're saying that that fair value makes sense because the fair value reflects really only the cash flows and the rates that are in the contractual terms of the swap, the fixed and the variable. So that's why changes in fair value capture exactly what it is we're trying to measure, which is the difference in cash flows. If it happened, and we're talking about true IFRS 13 fair value, we're not talking about a special fair value for this.
We are not discussing fair value. Fair values are fair values as
right.
for the market.
And when we say fair value, we do mean IFRS 13. Yeah. That's all good. I'm agreeing with that. But I think it's important to say that because in this case, the fair values of an interest rate swap by the nature of that instrument really reflect exactly what we are trying to find, which is the difference in cash flows. It's not incorporating other factors that could bring noise into the...
Mary, I don't want to go into the valuations of things. There could be credit involved, and the credit has to be incorporated. We haven't discussed options. Option hedging is also possible. That's not part of the core. It's secondary. We will come to that, and there both sides will have vol in it, and we will treat it very similarly, as is done in IFRS 9. So what we are saying is that the fair value delta gives you the measure of ineffectiveness, as is done in any other hedge accounting. We haven't considered the other instruments, and then we can come and consider that at that point in time. The other point, which is very important to clear, we have said one method, as you rightly pointed out, is the benchmark and the actual comparison.
Mm-hmm.
There can be other methods, which we haven't explored. But whatever method you go to, the conclusion is the delta comparison are the fair value changes of the derivative and the swaps, actual.
But how will people know that from those words? Measuring imperfect.
So we will clear that. Yeah.
Okay.
We'll clear that.
I was joking about making sure I know all the specifics I'm signing up to when it is very, helpfully high level language that reminds us of what the objective is that we're signing up to.
I agree with the staff view, and more particularly, I think with the analysis in paragraph 52. So my comment is just a comment on the way things are written, and I stumble on the logical link that you made between the measurement of imperfect alignment and the impact on the entity's future resources, because I would not qualify an opportunity cost as having an impact.
That's why we don't. No, fair enough.
And that's the source of my comment earlier.
We will clear that. Got it.
So I know I agree with you, but...
Relevant to this measuring imperfect alignment, I think we're agreeing that it's a change of fair value in the benchmark derivative, less the change in fair value of the designated derivatives. But in paragraph 128, you say the staff think that the DRM model should not specify a single method for assessing imperfect alignment. So I'm not sure how those two things fit together, because we've just spent a long time talking about how we measure imperfect alignment. So how does that fit with this sentence that comes later?
Well, I think the first point there is when we're talking about measurement and assessment, those are different things. So measurement involves the calculation figure, and the way that's generally done is through the deltas and PVs, and that's how it's done throughout 9 and throughout 39. I think when we talk about assessment later, and we talked about you have to prove the economic link and various other aspects of that, I think there are many other ways to prove that link necessarily than just a dollar offset type method. So,
okay, so the method, when we talk about a method, that's different from talking about how we're actually measuring something.
Yes.
Is that the difference?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, can I see who agrees with question 3?
Can you make sure on update that it's clear that we're referring to the things designated?
Yes, yeah. Of course.
14.
14. And we will also make clear that it's a delta fair values that we are looking at.
Yep. Okay. Section 3, communication of imperfect alignment. In this section, the staff discuss how imperfect alignments and the information content thereof should be communicated to users of financial reporting. More specifically, where do we include the difference between the change in fair value of the designated and benchmark derivatives, P&L or OCI? This paper does not discuss presentation within separate line items in the statement of profit or loss, nor does this paper discuss whether imperfect alignment should be disaggregated into components for presentation purposes. Both of these will be discussed as part of the core model, but at a future meeting when we discuss presentation and disclosure. The examples in paragraph 70 through 118 show what information would be provided in situations of over and under hedging, and I will discuss overhedging first and underhedging second. Regarding overhedging, while I will not delve into the details of the examples provided, charts 21 and 25 summarize the information provided in the case of overhedging if imperfect alignment is included in P&L, whereas charts 22 and 26 provide the information if imperfection is included in OCI. The staff have not considered an alternative where what we have termed the differences in accruals would be presented in OCI, because this implies presenting something in OCI that has already happened, i.e. a past transaction. The staff analysis regarding overhedging can be found in paragraphs 97 through 100, where we argue that alternative one is the preferred approach for overhedging. The information resulting from this alternative is equivalent to presenting the full change in fair value of the excess cash flows in the statement of profit or loss. With that, I would ask the board if they agree with the staff preliminary view in paragraph 101 that entity should apply alternative one and present imperfect alignment in the P&L where excess cash flows are present. As a secondary question, is there another alternative the board would like the staff to consider other than those presented?
I think in principle, I agree with alternative one. However, before I can really agree to it, I would like to see what happens to the profit and loss statement when the minute after I have measured those derivatives that were in excess would become hedging derivatives in their own right. So before I agree, I want to see how this develops in the dynamic nature of things. So agree in principle, but I'm not going to approve because I want to see how it develops dynamically before I can agree to the consequences.
I'm not arguing against. We have a plan. We will bring the full, as we bring the model together, we'll bring the final implications, because we realize that we have taken the board through different paths and you need to see the whole thing working together. I can give you an answer, but it's better to give you a demonstration of that, François, for your convincing. So let's say I have been overhedging derivatives for the first 6 months, and then on the first day of the seventh month, I have more items where it becomes absolutely balanced. Mm-hmm. I will show ineffectiveness for the first 6 months and nothing going forward, assuming I'm perfectly balanced. But we will, as we have said, we will bring it to you and demonstrate.
If that's the case, I agree. But that's not necessarily what I read from what we have in the paper.
That is the implication, exactly. And that's why the measurement points become important. We will demonstrate without it.
Sue?
I agree with staff's recommendation on this point. But I just want to peep ahead and flag something that I'm going to be very interested to come back to in later papers. And so I agree that we should end up with the difference being recognised in the statement of profit or loss, but it's going to be important to me what ends up in what line items in profit or loss, and to illustrate what I'm going to be thinking about to make sure it gets covered in the future. If you look at chart 20, if I look at the difference in here, X2, there's no total difference, so there'd be, I think, an overall zero impact in P&L, which I agree with. And I wouldn't be so keen if somebody could put that 5 in net interest income, the accrual of 5 in net interest income, for something which we're basically saying is, in effect, a trading derivative. So the line items and the extent of disaggregation that goes on is going to matter a lot to me.
Can I just come in to something which we have got it? There are two elements, I would say more than one element to it. We are talking about where you put the clean fair values in P&L, mm-hmm. when you have are ineffective. Remember, the accruals, we haven't done anything. They are going through and they affect NIM. So not only do we have to consider, so where you include that 5 and other things, you also have to see how that NIM balance affects when the line items go through pre, post hedging and where it goes. So we will come to it in quite a considerable level of detail. So it's got to be comprehensive, not just that clean fair value, and I think that's what you are after as well.
Not just imperfect, it's perfection as well.
Perfection should be talked about. Under over everything that we have come up with.
I'm out of.
Thanks, Hans. Just, I agree with staff as well. I just would like to stress you two aspects of your analysis that I really agree with. The first is the OCI assessment on paragraph 97 that you remind us that we only in exceptional circumstances, according to the conceptual framework, we might depart from recognizing something in P&L to OCI. Mm-hmm. And I do agree this is not an exceptional circumstances. That's the component that is not within the risk management. So I really support that assessment. And the other one is the overall objective to keep aligned with existing IFRSs and how similar transactions, economic transactions, are recognized and presented, in particular, in this case, the financial instruments and hedge accounting IFRS 9.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Gary? Yeah. That's efficient sharing.
Just two comments, one of which Amaro said about OCI and stuff. I think the minute we wrote conceptual framework, we've answered this question. There's nothing exceptional about it. I mean, this is standard BAU and at least the banks. To me, the easiest way to understand this, at least when you're dealing with over-hedging, and you say it in paragraph 82, think of it as two derivatives, one derivative for the exact amount that you need, and that gets classic hedge accounting, and a second derivative that's essentially trading or speculative because there is no hedge position. And so if you had the two derivatives, some will be in hung up the hedge model, some will be flowed through, and that gets you the exact same answer as the examples you've laid out here in your model, and I think that's important. But it's also a nice, simple way that people have some knowledge of this and can understand it. Think of it as two derivatives.
Agreed.
Anyways, and then with that, I do agree with your recommendation.
Thank you.
Constance.
Yeah, I would like to react to what you said about what we have in the conceptual framework, because I don't think that the OCI guidance that we have in the conceptual framework has exceptional as a criterion. I think the criterion in the conceptual framework is whether there would be a loss of relevance in the profit and loss statement, and the assessment of the board that this loss of relevance would be exceptional. So the criterion is would there be a loss of relevance in the income statement, and not whether it's exceptional. I think it's important. I mean, I agree with the staff recommendation, as I've said, but I think it's important that this is not read as being a criterion in itself. It's an assessment that the real criterion would not be verified often.
Mary.
I had a comment about one piece of the analysis in this paper, but doesn't change my support for staff recommendation in the question. And after Sue spoke, I wanted to sign up also to her caveat peeking forward about the line items being important.
Yep.
The comment I had is about the analysis in paragraph 63 and then something that's also said in paragraph 66. It's focused on the timing of measurement, but it's the discussion of what happens if you have to change your, in this example, prepayment assumptions. And you use the term a couple of times about the old assumption being inaccurate. And while we're talking about assumptions, so I think I would call that an input into the MOP?
And we have distinguished that from an input.
Okay.
Very clear, Mary, because an assumption has a different measurement implications.
Okay. So, but we are talking about changes in assumption as you get new information that you did not have available before. I think I would steer away from calling the assumptions in previous periods inaccurate, as opposed to thinking about them as being updated based on new information. When I read this and I tried to think about it through the lens of IS-8 and estimates, because to me at heart, this is what it is you're trying to estimate the prepayment, if I went through the guidance in ISA on estimates, I think I'd come to the same conclusion that the staff had, which is that the change in fair value as a result of updating your assumptions, sorry, the change in imperfection, which is measured by change in fair value as a result of updating your assumptions, should all be recognized in the current period rather than spread, is the same conclusion I would come to if I applied the general estimate analysis. And that is because the way we are measuring it, which is the change in fair value, reports in the current period all, you know, all changes. I think it would say it's a current period event. So I think it would be helpful to stay away from calling the previous ones inaccurate, which almost imply that you should go back and revise the effectiveness that you report, you know, the imperfection that you reported in previous periods. But I come to the same outcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, I also support the staff's recommendation. I support alternative one. But I have one comment with regard to the breach of qualifying criteria. When I read paragraph, you know, 66 to 69, I'm always thinking that a breach of qualifying criteria, the nature of breaching of qualifying criteria, is exactly the same as other overhedging or unhedging scenarios. Because for other overhedging or unhedging situations, those financial assets or liabilities, whatever the under or excess, they meet the qualifying criteria. But in this case, those financial assets and liabilities are not meet the qualifying criteria. So that means DRM accounting model could not apply for those situations. So if the nature of breach of qualifying criteria is different, then the resulting impact will be same or not. Suppose there is another case, because we're using the case about the high profile, highly probable future transactions. Suppose there is a financial asset. As the first day, they measured at amortizing cost, so it meets the assets profile qualifying criteria. But at the second day, because of some liquidity risk management purpose, the entity decided to sell those company those financial assets to reclassify, or maybe change their business model. So reclassify those financial assets measured at amortized cost to be measured at fair value through P&L. So in this case, it seems that the risk management strategy changed, and then result in, you know, those financial assets did not qualify for those qualified criteria at all. So in this case, as if this happened, it's also relevant to agenda paper 4C, because this kind of change resulting from the risk management strategy change. So whether the result impact or result accounting treatment should be same as other over-hedging or under-hedging situations.
As of now, if you breach qualifying criteria, you have the consequences as outlined in the paper. A change in risk management strategy is much bigger than just breaching qualifying criteria. You are changing your entire target profile. So that is why it has been cut and put separately in a separate paper, Jinchao, because the consequences and the economics are very different.
Yeah, but maybe in some cases, why the company breach of qualifying criteria? Because of they changed the risk management strategy.
But I think so. Sorry, yeah. What we're saying is if someone has changed the risk management strategy such that they no longer meet the qualifying criteria, they would apply the breach guidance. They would not apply the change in strategy guidance, because that is a breach of qualifying criteria. If you have changed your business model such that all assets are no longer amortized cost, that's a breach. And you would apply the breach guidance as outlined in the paper. That's not a change in risk management strategy as we've defined.
Jinchao's broader point is we'll need to be clear which category you fall into.
Doug?
The point raised by Jin Chao was exactly the point I wanted to discuss at the first question. So actually, the impact of breach of qualifying criteria is same as the imperfectness against the benchmark. So therefore, the how frequently and how effectively monitors whether or not there is a breach of contract, and the quality of benchmark derivative is really the key. Otherwise, if that quality is quite poor, even if they did monitor the imperfectness against the benchmark derivative is quite intensively done, we are missing something. So therefore, that must be clarified in disclosure, or that must be monitored. Or is there any way for the accounting perspective to require to monitor the qualification of these criteria? You're not going to require it in the accounting standards. So it will totally leave it to the management.
We have proposed qualifying criteria that have to be met for you to get into the model. But if you don't meet the criteria, you are disqualified. Okay. So that's specified in the standard tag.
Right. But the monitoring?
The monitoring will come in from the measurement requirements. So every time you change the inputs,
okay,
it results
every
in.
Every time it's changed, it should be monitored.
I fully appreciate, I think we are on the same page. I'm just trying to re-articulate. The importance of the benchmark derivative is critical because it is just driven by the what is your asset profile and what your target profile. Obviously, we'll come to that with disclosure because without that, I agree, every aspect of it, if I don't tie that down, doesn't work.
Yeah.
Okay, can I see who agrees with question number 4?
All in favor? 14?
And 13.
13.
Is there... Sir. Is there any alternative the board would like the staff to consider?
No.
That is not the case. Okay.
Thank you. All in favor of that? Yep.
So was it 13 or 14?
13 for question 4, 14 for question 5.
Yeah, that I wouldn't vote because I see developed dynamically. I agree in principle.
No, no, as I said, we will come back with the
13 and a half. Okay.
Abstain.
13
and 1 abstain. Your vote only counts for half anyway.
No, it doesn't. Is anybody listening?
No, it doesn't.
Some seem to think so.
Moving on to underhedging. So underhedging are situations where there are insufficient cash flows. This is discussed in paragraphs 102 through 117. Similarly to overhedging, a detailed example is provided, and the information that would result is provided in charts 29 and 30. This summarizes the information in the P&L. Staff analysis can be found in paragraphs 110 through 116, where the staff highlight the applicability of the lower of test to the DRM accounting model, and highlight that both alternatives imply recognizing in financial statements amounts related to transactions that have not and may not occur. The staff would comment that recognizing such amounts in financial reporting may be problematic, as this implies recognizing something analogous to an opportunity cost. Consequently, as stated in paragraph 116, in order to communicate the impact of perfect alignment, disclosures are likely required, given recognition is likely not an option in the case of underhedging. Moving on to the question, so does the board agree that the lower of test should be retained within the DRM accounting model, and that as a result, disclosures are likely required to fully communicate the impact of imperfect alignment in the case of underhedging?
Question 6, right?
I agree with the staff's position. I thought you argued this very well, to such the extent that we couldn't disagree with you. Lower of test seemed to be we had to do it, and similarly, we can't recognise something that doesn't exist. So I think the discussion is about recognition first. Can you recognise yes or no? And then when you get the no answer to recognition, then you decide what to do.
Yes. Thanks, Anne. Thank you, try that with everyone. Doesn't work every time.
I also agree with the staff's recommendation, even though when I started out I felt a bit sick. You convinced me as well. But part of what convinces me is that I think we still can get information content, And it will, of course, depend on what the disclosures are that we require. But if I look at the chart on page 108, chart 30, those total reported results give you quite a lot of information if you knew that the target was 20.
Exactly.
And I think that's what we need to focus on. But the only sort of caveat I did have to this example, and I know that you've used quite extreme numbers to make a point with your figures, so the fact that we've got somebody who's set out to hedge 1,000 and using a notional of 750, I just don't want people in the market to think that we think that's
normal.
That's acceptable. Going to meet the assessment criteria in terms of being a good enough fit to get into the hedge accounting model in the first place, because even with the lower of test, if you look at chart 28, the difference of what would have gone to P&L absent the hedge accounting and what ends up in P&L because of the hedge accounting is quite stark. And so the fact that we've let people use the model, even though there's an under-hedge type situation, we have to be careful how much of that we allow. So we're not going to want somebody who's only set out to use a notional of 100 hedging 1,000 and saying, yeah, that's fine. Yeah. But okay. I'm presuming that's implicit in our assessment criteria.
Yes, and as I said in the tee-up, no inference should be made regarding the numbers.
Because we used the other one also was, it could be. Can I just re-emphasize one of the points which I was trying to, is this focus on chart 30? When we're in over-hedging, we looked at what was the content, where the ineffectiveness will go. But even, that's why I was coming back to it, Sue, even in that case, that chart, the same chart applies, but you have the higher one. And you can only make that assessment when you have an estimate of what, coming to Tark's point, is the target profile and how well you have done that. And so it is not just the fair value PV differences, although we focus quite a bit on that. It's also how the NIM will work in this. I use NIM very loosely. Interest income and expense will work in this one. So that will be the critical part where I was saying the disclosure element has to be comprehensive to cover this vector as well.
Mary?
Speaking of disclosure, I think I agree with the staff's sentiment, but I don't agree with the wording of point B in question six, because I agree that the retaining the lower of test and sign up to everything Anne said about that. But I think we have to look at what disclosure requirements we have as a whole, and we shouldn't start to make individual conclusions about pieces yet. So I agree with what I think the sentiment is, that in the case of under-hedging, the measurement of the imperfection has information value, and we should think about how to communicate that information value. But I don't want, I mean, I think I would end up supporting disclosure of it, but I don't want to start doing bits and pieces of disclosure rather than looking at it as a whole.
So can I just, absolutely fair, Mary, no problems. If we say that what we are asking, one, the lower of test, and secondly, the measurement of imperfection in case of under-hedging has information value, which we will consider later.
Which should be communicated, you know, we should look to communicate.
Okay. That should be okay.
One way or another. Françoise.
Well, I agree with the recommendation on the staff, but I also have a comment about the information value of the measurement imperfection when you have under-hedging. I think that information really helps meeting the objective of reporting whether the risk management strategy has been effective. So that's why I thought it was important to identify the two objectives. And as a result, I think it's an area where when ranges exist, they should play a role. So I would see more information value in reporting the effects of the risk management strategy being beyond the ranges. And I would still, within the ranges, I would still consider that, in fact, it's working well, and I would not provide information.
So can I just articulate so that make sure we've understood it correctly? So what you're saying is that the information content is not just there for over, it's also equally there for under, and also when you are in the range. So we should consider what the whole spectrum is going to be when we think of information.
I'm saying that to me, the information responds to the objective of of assessing whether the risk management strategy is effective, and I would provide information insofar as it is ineffective.
On both sides. Yeah.
and we'll...
Thank you. On this disclosure, we need to clarify this kind of a disclosure requirement is not required on individual hedge, on the hedge count, right?
Mm. Yeah, so in IFRS 7, I don't think there's a requirement to disclose this figure.
Mm. So this is a kind of a different requirement from the IFRS 7.
We will bring it, Chengbu, but yes, possibly we will not give the same recommendation. Okay.
All right, just a clarification.
Can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
With the modification proposed by Mary.
What
that
is it? Yeah. Modification.
But to basically the measurement of imperfection in case of underhedging also communicates information, which we will consider later when we think disclosures. Or do you have
a better Mary's way? Idea is not to give enough prominence at this stage to a particular aspect of disclosure and then bring it back with the package of disclosure.
I'm not sure if I look at my target of 20 and the total reported results I get on chart 30, whether that is the same as the measurement of imperfection or not.
It's more than that.
I think we need to be careful.
So it means I'm working on the fly. It means we can say that the board agreed that...
We need to consider how to
disclosure related to this.
Yeah, how to communicate... under hedging.
By the way, hadn't we just agreed in the disclosure framework that we would not just be looking at disclosures at the very end, but that we would be looking as we go?
But you are agreeing to that, Hans.
No, but
we have just haven't given you the exact specifics.
Okay.
We're still in test phase with that. and
I think it's also telling us we should be identifying information that we want to collect, but I don't think it says we should be making decisions about requirements on a piecemeal basis.
Okay.
The vote was 13, and then, Francoise, were you abstaining again?
Did you abstain again, Francois?
No.
So,
okay,
13. 14?
13.
But no, I didn't.
Oh, you did raise your hand.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. 14.
So 14 in favor for both. Okay.
Excellent.
With the modification.
But for both, I mean, I mentioned.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Okay.
Right. 7. Moving on. Target profile defined as a range. Prior, moving on to assessment and minimum performance thresholds. Staff have considered whether the model should contemplate any ranges for the specific purposes of measurement in paragraphs 119 through 126. The staff acknowledged almost every risk management strategy will be defined as a range and have provided some examples in the paper. Therefore, there is an argument to consider risk limits given the objective to reflect risk management faithfully. However, the staff would comment that the concept of risk limits was considered during the PRA and the board received feedback that they should not be considered for the reasons stated in paragraphs 124. Such, moving on to the question, does the board agree that the target profile should be defined as a single possible outcome?
Martin.
Well, I agree, but I'm struggling in how does it fit if really risk management is defining their overall strategy in a range? How does it really fit? Because if I would say as a risk manager, okay, or as a board from a bank saying, okay, risk management, please operate in a certain range, and you're doing that, then how do you translate that then in this accounting model?
For example, if someone says I've got an NII limit of plus or minus 7.5% of the stated figure, I would take the midpoint.
They have to define
midpoint in the range. Yeah. And the risk manager has to do something artificial to follow or to achieve an accounting.
Well, I think most risk management strategies will define a figure, and then they will say the acceptable deviation from that figure is X or Y.
Let me come to two things, Martin. Quoting you, you can never perfectly represent risk management.
It was a question. Always had a question. How does it? Because I wanted to avoid that people afterwards saying, okay, my risk manager is in the range and that is requiring me a certain point, and so it does not fit. That was a reason.
I appreciate it.
So you have solutions, okay, you can translate that. That was my question. How do you translate
it? It's a very good solution.
Good point.
But it's not that we are saying it can't be. First, on the feedback of the PRA, nobody wanted that. Second, yes, it can be. It just makes it more complicated. Let's see what they have to say. This was something we will get to hear.
And later we will talk about simplification. So even if you maybe not have the midpoint, you are then coming with...
There are other ways of achieving similar results.
Daryl?
It was a deadly comment.
I just wanted to ask something further on that then. When I'd read this, my assumption was that most banks would probably tend to go for the upper limit just because of the difference in the treatment between underhedging and overhedging. Are we thinking that we might provide guidance suggesting the midpoint, or that we might ask you to report on your effectiveness relative to the midpoint?
There's nothing in here in the paper in any of the formal recommendations where we say midpoint. That was a comment that was made saying how you might do it. So I think right now we're just saying you have to define your target profile, and that should be reflective of your risk management strategy. I think to say the point there is that you probably, when you define your risk management strategy, if it's defined as a range, it has to be a range around some number. So you have to be able to quantify it as a figure.
And your other question we will come to last. What is the gating?
So I thought what we would be saying would be, even if you've got a range, you need to designate in a way where you've chosen a point, if you like. I guess I can already hear there may be a risk that they'll say, and then I'm going to be showing as being imperfect, even though I perfectly met my target because I was within my range. So I guess peeping ahead to the disclosure package, it would be probably useful to think about whether there's a way of trying to tease out and thinking about disclosure, the ability to say, you know, my outcome was this amount of imperfection, and whether or not that is consistent with what the risk management objective was.
Yeah.
So it's not seen as a failure, because I can imagine they'll say, but I didn't fail, so why are you making me reflect it as if it were failure? So I think we need to think carefully about the interaction with the actual risk management.
Gary,
I can see the issues or why people might disagree with it as a range. And I can understand how it might complicate the mechanics. But I don't still necessarily find expressing as a range as nefarious or all that problematic, especially in paragraph 124B. It says risk limits are a technique for internal risk management. It kind of seems that we're trying to represent that. But intuitively, it strikes me you might have a problem defining a ceiling and a floor, but it strikes me as a lot easier to express it. So with that as a setup, if you want to express it as a single number, presumably it's by each risk management pool. You know, you might have many of them in a bank, but it's not one number for the whole institution. But given that inputs change daily, you know, hourly, whether it's inputs, duration, whatever, is how practical is it to express it as an absolute number, and how often would you need to adjust it?
Well, so I think to have an effective risk limit framework, even if it's for internal risk management purposes, it has to come down to a number that people agree on. If it's an internal control process, you can't really say, well, I think I'm within my ranges. So you have to be able to say yes or no, which means there has to be a defined mathematical answer to that. So I think it's quite reasonable to expect people to be able to define a number and then define the ranges around that number. As to the comment as to how frequently are these ranges updated, that depends on the institution. And so I'm not sure that we can comment about frequency of changes in governance structures.
But it's not a simple change to change that number based on the way we have put it.
Yeah, but then how do you account for volume changes? I mean, and also earlier we've discussed you got to contemplate forecasted transactions and rollovers and stuff. So proposed changing constantly.
But your target isn't, Gary. It's 10%, let's say NIM of 7% on whatever is the existing portfolio.
And that's how you express it as
one
7% NIM?
7% net position. I don't want to use
that. It's not like it's 100 million euros.
So it would be a calculated figure of everything within the scope of that policy, and then anything within the scope of that policy would derive the figure, and then it's a variation around that figure. So it's
expressing it as Kumar just said, is, you know, 7% or 700 basis points. So that's one way to express it. You could express an absolute dollar.
I have seen people do it absolute to say, we think that the absolute number is what matters rather than a relative number, and I've seen people do it as a relative number. Different institutions will have a different opinion on that, and that's reality.
And looking forward to whenever a due process document goes out, will we permit or allow all those, or will we express a preference?
I'm not sure we've contemplated what our thoughts would be on that. So,
Tom?
Well, just sort of to understand, I think Ross said that typically you would choose a number and then develop a range by putting some confidence intervals or something around it. Is that right?
One way of doing it, yes.
Would anybody ever specify a distribution fairly precisely as opposed to a number?
I think it's difficult for me to comment on how every single person has to define their risk governance framework.
I'll rephrase then. Would it be exceptionally rare for somebody to do what I just asked?
Exceptionally rare, given difficult to answer these questions, Tom. I haven't seen it. Ross hasn't seen it. That doesn't mean nobody has done it that way.
Yeah, I would suspect it was quite rare, but I was just thinking, because the way Ross phrased it, if almost everybody works from the number to the range, then this makes more sense than if somehow people work from a distribution to a number. And a distribution also, I mean, you know, is it normal, is it skewed or whatever? Then things kind of maybe what Daryl was saying, you know, then maybe the number you pluck out of it, if you start with a distribution and pluck a number out of it, then maybe that can be a bit strategic, the number you would pluck out. So it hadn't really occurred to me, that's why I asked. But if it's generally what you've described, I think we're in a
I'm sure
good
we'll
place.
Get to hear of it in outreach. Some people will, it means that's all I can, I don't know, I haven't seen it, Tom.
Okay.
Okay. Question seven. Who agrees?
14?
14. Okay, the last bit.
Assessment of perfect alignment. So given the board has agreed with the staff recommendations thus far, a consequence of maintaining the lower of test is the creation of a lower bound risk tolerance for presenting imperfect alignment in the statement of profit or loss. Such for this reason and those stated in paragraphs 130 and 131, the staff believe a minimum performance threshold is required. The staff considered two alternatives for minimum performance thresholds. Firstly, a quantitative threshold or alternatively a qualitative threshold that would be supported by quantitative analysis. The staff think these minimum performance thresholds would be prospective in nature given measurement is inherently retrospective in nature. Therefore, we see reduced benefit in completing a retrospective assessment given an already existing requirement for retrospective measurement. The staff discussed the advantages and disadvantages of quantitative thresholds in paragraphs 135 through 138, and the same for qualitative in paragraphs 139 through 141, with the staff preliminary view summarized in paragraph 147. Frequency of that assessment and the implications for failing are discussed in paragraphs 142 through 146. And the staff would summarize that since the assessment is prospective in nature, it should be completed after all changes are completed to the items within the DRM model, including any additional mitigating actions required. Therefore, to conclude, does the board agree with questions 8 and 9 that a minimum performance requirement should exist within the model and that it should be qualitative in nature supported by quantitative analysis? Does the board agree that this assessment should be completed on an ongoing basis?
Sure.
I do agree. I'm just to comment on one point that was made about the forward-looking versus the retrospective. I certainly would agree with not saying that you would need to discontinue applying the model because something had gone wrong in the past period. So I certainly would say don't backward look in that sense. But when you're making your assessment, if looking forward, you've got a good economic hedge or not, presumably one thing you would need to think about was it a disaster last period or not? So I think I wouldn't say you're blind to it, but I wouldn't say it would, you know, old-fashioned, you know, if it was bad in the past, you stop. I would agree with that if that's what you mean.
Yes.
Yeah.
Drilling down, I think, into a little bit for where you're coming from specifics, let me give you a specific example. For the last three periods, all your highly probable forecast projections have come to naught.
Yeah.
Fine, you've picked it up, but that calls into question from a different angle
exactly.
Whether you can continue going forward.
I think you should have a more difficult conversation with your auditor in that
exactly.
case.
Meeting the assumptions.
Or if there's been a massive misalignment between your designated derivatives and your benchmark derivative in the past,
and
massively out, and you don't know why, I'd want you to be having a more difficult conversation about why you still think this is a good fit going forward.
I think to your point, if there's a massive delta, then I think you could question the strength of the link between there and the quantitative part of the analysis we're recommending. I think absolutely. That's entirely consistent. Yeah.
Okay. Absolutely.
And Zhao.
Thank you. I agree with staff's proposal, but before we vote, I think the paper discussed a lot of IFRS 9's qualitative threshold that includes quantitative analysis. But here the question is asked about dynamic risk management, what kind of qualitative threshold we should have, and what kind of quantitative analysis we should have. But it seemed to me it's not very clear what kind of qualitative threshold for dynamic risk management we should have. It should be same, I think it should not be same. So I think it should be based on dynamic risk management and then develop some kind of qualitative threshold, such as illustrate what kind of economic relationship we should have, because it's different. Whether those designated derivatives really transform assets profile that such as it's equal to the target profile, what kind of hedge ratio we should have with regard to the dynamic risk management activities. So I think it's better to have this kind of thing much more clear based on IFRS 9, but the threshold should be based on the dynamic risk management activities, yes.
Fair enough, Jinchao. What you're telling us, and if I read it correctly, you agree with the concept of minimum threshold.
Yeah, I agree with the concept.
The specifics you would like us to bring back in the context of a DRM.
Yeah.
Fair point. Agreed?
I had exactly the same point, Mr. Jinchao.
Yeah, okay. That's a fair point. Can I ask for a vote on in this way that do you agree with the preliminary view in paragraph 1 that the minimum performance referred should be qualitative thresholds and not quantitative benchmarks like as before and supported by quantitative analysis? That's just the principle that we are asking for. Can I get a vote on that? 14. Okay. I think that the other view we are asking for, and I will caveat that this will be done on an ongoing basis. What the exact tests will be with the thresholds, we will come back to the board for their decision at a future meeting. Is that fair?
Yeah.
Can I get a vote on that, please? All in favor? Thank you. We are done with 4B.
Okay, we'll take a break. 1:50.